This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. When the stock market crashed in 2008, many people were quick to point fingers at the real estate industry, big banks, policymakers. Some even blamed it on testosterone. Those critics argued that this hormone increased recklessness and aggression in realtors and traders, leading them to take unscrupulous and idiotic risks. Testosterone has long been blamed and at times praised for causing aggressive, impulsive, or bold behavior. That's problematic for a few reasons, not the least of which being the stereotype of masculinity as thoughtless risk-taking. But another problem is that testosterone does not just affect men.
My name is Brooke. I'm calling from Salt Lake City, and I was diagnosed with extremely low testosterone. I was told by my doctor that it can lead to infertility, and for a while I was receiving testosterone therapy through these little pill insert things that would just steadily release testosterone into my bloodstream. Very interesting time in my life. I was one of my doctor's youngest patients, which felt really odd, but yeah, I had no idea how important testosterone was to all around women's health.
That is one of dozens of voicemails you left in our inbox. So testosterone affects everyone. But how? What do we know? What have we assumed? And how might all that reshape what it means to be a man? Joining us from NPR in New York are Rebecca Jordan Young and Katrina Karkazis, the authors of the new book, Testosterone, An Unauthorized Biography. Professor Jordan Young is a socio-medical scientist who teaches women's, gender, and sexuality studies at Barnard College. Professor Karkazis is a cultural anthropologist, a chair of the Honors Academy at Brooklyn College, and a senior research fellow at Yale's Global Health Justice Partnership. Professors, it's great to have you both with us. Welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Josh. Good to be here.
We'd love to hear from you, too. How has your understanding of testosterone or maybe lack of understanding affected you? Maybe you've been rethinking what it means in terms of masculinity. Maybe you take testosterone for an array of reasons. Email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Professor Karkazis, let's start with the title of the book. Why unauthorized biography? Did you just not bother to get testosterone's permission before you told its story?
I actually would say we didn't, and I have to give Beck credit for coming up with a really fantastic title. The reason it's unauthorized is that part of really what we're talking about in the book is a 100-year-long narrative about this hormone and the way it's been gendered, including that many people understand it to be a male hormone, a male sex hormone, and that part of what we wanted to do was write something that interrogated sort of the idea of what this hormone does, including that it's responsible for all things manly, as it were. So we look at a bunch of different domains of behavior where testosterone is thought to be important, and we look at critical studies, and we try to look at those studies both for what they actually say, but also the way the story, the narrative, the biography of testosterone is also deeply implicated in the science and is critical to what the science shows.
Professor Jordan Young, let's start with just a very basic question. What is testosterone, basically?
Well, this is it's a great question because testosterone is both a specific molecule with a particular structure. It's something that, you know, is a very concrete specific material thing, but it's also a figure in a cultural narrative, what Katrina was talking about. And one of the things that's super fascinating is that it's not entirely possible to separate out that singular molecule from the narrative. So the molecule as one particular structure exists for sure, but as one singular thing, it only exists that way in the abstract, because in bodies, it's always in relation to other molecules that are around it, to the particular receptors and how those receptors act. It's always on the move, being transformed from a different steroid or transforming into another steroid, including estrogen. So it's singular, but it's also super dynamic, and it's always part of a system. And what our book takes on is this complicated idea that part of that system is the narrative. And that narrative shapes, for example, the way scientists are able to imagine their experiments, to interpret them, what they decide to measure, and so on.
Well, as it relates to that narrative, we mentioned the 2008 financial crisis at the top and this idea that financial recklessness is tied to testosterone in men. Let's just start there. It sounds like that's an example of part of the narrative that you and Professor Karkazis are trying to unravel.
Yes, it is. So there was a particular study. This narrative was already out there. People already thought that that was, that testosterone is behind any sort of reckless, risky, dominant, aggressive behavior that men were taking on. So this idea didn't come about at the point of the economic crash, but there were people working on the idea, and one particular study got a lot of play for the idea that that men on the traders, financial traders on the London trading floor had that there were data that showed that their higher testosterone was ramping up this risk cycle. And so it's such an appealing story. It fits so neatly into what people already thought was going on that we were quite surprised to take a look at the study and find that the core theory about it, which is that if you get a small win, testosterone is super dynamic. At this point, scientists recognize that it responds to social situations, things like status challenges, things like intense exercise, but many things it responds to. So the idea was if traders started getting a lot of wins, their testosterone would go up, and that would create this loop where they would then take more risks, and it would keep going up. And so they hypothesized that that on days when they were having greater wins, that the testosterone would jump up and increase risks the next day. And it turns out they actually never measured the things that they would need to prove that hypothesis. But it got a lot of play as if the study actually supported it. And this is the kind of thing we see over and over again, that the idea that's already there in the first place carries a lot of studies along where the data themselves are not precise enough to actually support the theory.
Professor Karkazis, how does the research and the book relate to today's views of manhood, of masculinity? How do you want those two to intersect?
Well, it's interesting because I think people might have the impression in thinking about the book that it's somehow about what's wrong with men or how to be a better man. But the book actually isn't really about men at all. It's about this concept of masculinity and what gets attached to it and the desire to question sort of some of those attachments. So, for example, testosterone is gendered, right? It is understood as masculine. And once we define something as masculine, aggression, you know, violence, risk-taking, then it excludes women from that particular behavior. But we all know that women can be brave, they can be strong, they can be violent as well. And so there is no trait that is, or behavior that is, on its own manly, because all people participate in these behaviors. So part of what we want to do is start to question the fact that testosterone is often at the root of the idea that certain behaviors are masculine or manly and are not the province of women. And why it's important is that if we understand men's ways of being that are very often culturally coded and conscripted as coming from the hormone, then it naturalizes those ways of being and the hierarchies that exist around those, where women will often be in the one-down position. And I'm just thinking quickly of Kate Mann's work, who's a philosopher who I really like, because what she says is that misogyny is not hatred of women. It's the mechanism designed to keep women in their place when they step outside that upholds patriarchy. And why I'm mentioning that now is because if we understand men to be aggressive or dominant or more risk-taking, that women are not naturally that way because of different levels of testosterone, then when women step outside of that, it's viewed as unusual and something that needs to be kept in check. And part of what we want to do is remove the biological basis for some of those arguments, really in an effort to expand the idea of what can count as masculine.
We heard from quite a few of you who have used testosterone as it relates to low naturally occurring levels. Here's a quick mashup of some of what you left in our inbox.
I have chronically low testosterone and have had it most of my life.
I talked to my doctor and told him I just don't have any energy. You know, I'm just kind of lethargic all the time. My sex drive is down.
I was struggling in life. I was having trouble getting out of bed. And the straw that broke the camel's back for me is when I was all of a sudden thinking about suicide as an option, and started doing therapy, ended up doing some medical testing and discovered that my body had stopped producing testosterone.
I started injecting testosterone 0.5 mL per week for a few years now. Ever since then, my weight has dropped. I'm much more enthusiastic about sex, and I feel much better.
We started on a weekly regimen, and it is the closest thing to a silver bullet I've ever experienced.
Thank you all very much for sharing your stories with us, and I'd like to pick up with some of those stories when we continue our conversation with Professors Rebecca Jordan-Young and Katrina Karkasis, the co-authors of Testosterone, an Unauthorized Biography. We'll add one more voice to the conversation in just a moment, and we'll get to some more of your questions and stories as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing testosterone with sociomedical scientist Rebecca Jordan-Young and cultural anthropologist Katrina Karkasis, the co-authors of the book Testosterone, an Unauthorized Biography. We'd love to hear from you, too. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Professor Jordan-Young, I'd love to get your reaction to some of the stories we heard about people who are on testosterone replacement therapy. Let me add one more to the mix. Here's one from Lindsay, who emailed, "I'm a 41-year-old woman who recently took a hormone panel, a battery of tests for your hormone levels." Lindsay writes, "My doctor said levels under 100 for testosterone were low for a woman. Mine was 12. 12! I just started laughing. Is this why I'm so tired? He said that was definitely a factor. I take 2 clicks of testosterone a day, and it's given me a much-needed boost." Professor Jordan-Young, what can you tell us about what these listeners have told us about their trouble with energy levels, depression, sex drive as a result of low testosterone?
Well, I'm so happy that so many people called in with those great experiences. And to me, actually, you know, it makes a whole lot of sense. I will say, when we talk about testosterone or when people hear a quick overview of the book, sometimes they think that what we're saying is, oh, testosterone doesn't really do anything. And that's so far from what we're saying. What we're saying is actually testosterone does so much that it's really a mistake to try to capture its actions by the idea of masculinity. And so one of the ways that it's helpful to think about this is many of the people who called in were having some very particular problems with systemic issues like energy, like fatigue, like depression, really the kind of thing that any major disruption of sort of broad systems would have this broad array of effects. Testosterone is one actor in this, you know, whole complex dynamic system that we have, and for sure, if your levels are disrupted for you, then it's a really good idea to get that in place. But no responsible clinician would just take somebody's levels and say, oh, your levels are off, let's bring you up, unless there were some problems going on that you had come in with in the first place. And the reason for that is levels alone don't really tell you what testosterone is doing in somebody's body. It's such a dynamic process, and our individual responses to testosterone are so variable, including within one individual over time, how you respond is really different. I want to just give you a sense of a couple of other chemicals that people know about and we think about. Like, imagine potassium. So potassium is a nutrient. It's in a lot of things. We don't have a huge cultural narrative around potassium, but if you have ever had, in particular, a really elderly person in your life, somebody who's been, on a lot of medications or dealing with a lot of fluid loss, if somebody's electrolytes, like potassium, get way out of balance, you wouldn't believe the effects. I mean, there's an incredible dementia problem that happens. There are huge cognitive and energy problems that happen. Balance is messed up, all kinds of stuff. We don't then think about potassium as the magic bullet for cognition or the magic bullet for balance or something, but for sure, if it's messed up, you're not functioning well. Likewise, you know, one of the areas where people really think that testosterone is the thing that supercharges you is in sexual functioning.
Right.
And for sure, having levels of testosterone that are way below normal, and in particular, way low for you, are going to mess with your sexual function. But testosterone alone isn't going to fix that. And boosting your testosterone to really high levels isn't then going to give you, you know, supercharging your sex life. It's all about the interesting thing is, beyond a certain pretty low level, more testosterone doesn't make a lot of difference with sexual function. And one of the hormones that really surprises people, especially around male sexual function, it turns out that one of the biggest ways that testosterone has some of its effects, including with erection, including with libido, is through its conversion to estrogen.
Yeah.
Because testosterone converts to estrogen in the body, some portion of it does, so it can either work directly on testosterone receptors or indirectly by, you know, converting. In studies where they block the conversion to estrogen, people don't get, you know, their full sexual function. In fact, it seems to be a roughly equal contribution, the testosterone and estrogen.
I do want to come back to that in a little bit, but let's add another voice to the conversation. Great. Also with us from NPR in New York, Thomas Page McBee is a journalist, amateur boxer, and the author of several books, including Amateur, A Reckoning with Gender, Identity, and Masculinity. He identifies as transgender. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You started taking testosterone and transitioning when you were about 30. What were some of the first things you began to notice?
Well, I mean, you know, in terms of like my transition physically, it was exactly as I expected it to be. I think a lot of what interests people about trans people is not interesting to me. Like, I think the experience of taking testosterone and having my body change, I mean, that was just like, you know, it brought me into alignment with how I imagined myself to be. But what was interesting to me about taking testosterone was that the way other people reacted to me changed dramatically. And it was very hard in the first few years for me to sort of tell the difference between what was happening, you know, because I was on testosterone and because my body was changing. And initially it felt confusing, like, you know, because of the input I was getting from the world around me, is this because I'm different or is this because the world's different, if that makes sense, or the way I'm seen in the world is different?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I pretty quickly realized that, you know, so much of what people seemed to expect from me was very much social, because when I was alone or at home or with my family or with people who knew me, I was very much the same person, you know. But if I left the house and literally was walking down the street, it was like between, you know, being a threat in a way that I understand but I wasn't expecting, you know, being read as a threat by women in particular, in certain situations around safety, like walking down the street at night alone with a woman, like she would always cross the street, that sort of thing. But also even just like going into my work environment and having, you know, a lot of privileges around like what people like thought I was capable of in a way that really didn't make sense because I hadn't changed my, you know, professional capacity. I had just changed the way I looked physically.
So you kind of had another perspective on sexism, on chauvinism.
Sure. And then the reverse of that, I felt like I knew for a fact that, you know, the way in which I was expected to behave was also very constricted. You know, that's what sociologists call the man box. But this idea that I had to restrict my emotions, be very stoic, you know, not Not show weakness, all of those things. Even though I knew and had a sense that I wanted to resist that going in, it was really challenging when it was just a constant environmental, stimulation to actually truly avoid that. And it took a lot of work and energy to counter that. And in fact, that's why I wrote a whole book about it.
Now, when you decided to formally transition, was testosterone a necessary part of that transition for you? Had you ever considered the potential of trying to transition without taking it?
I mean, that's such a valid choice. For me, because of the dysphoria I was experiencing, I'd had top surgery a few years before I started testosterone, and I definitely spent many years of my life trying to find a way to live within a gender identity that worked for me. And for me, in the end, like, testosterone was important because of, you know, the way I knew my appearance would change and the way I wanted to feel in my body. So for me, that's what worked best. It's not the only way to transition. And, you know, I don't think it's the best way, but for me, that was the right way.
In your book, Amateur, you talk about learning to box and being the first known transgender man to box at Madison Square Garden in New York. What made you decide to start boxing?
Yeah, so I have a story about that. It'll take 1 minute to explain, but just to give you a heads up. So the reason why I started boxing was actually related to what I was describing earlier, which is the first few years of my transition, I was working as a journalist. I was reporting on the masculinity crisis that was happening, because this was 2011 that I started my transition. And I got really interested in the economic story and the social story. At the same time, I felt like the way it was being framed was almost as if all of these aspects of masculinity were sort of inevitable, kind of like we're talking about testosterone. And that didn't seem quite right to me. Like, I felt that man box constriction from the very beginning, but nobody was ever talking about that, at least in the reporting. So a few years into my transition, I was struggling, because I felt like happy to be who I was and happy to have this body and to have gone through this experience, but I felt like I hadn't come out the other side feeling like I could really have an authentic experience of gender. And that was really frustrating, because I felt like I was being so constricted in all these ways, and because I felt like the way privilege was happening wasn't something that people really understood, and I really wanted to speak to that. But I was feeling like there was no way out, and I would talk to my male friends and I'd say, you know, like, well, what do you do if you're in a locker room and guys say, like, things you don't agree with or whatever? And the guys around me would always say, you know, well, that's just how guys are, or you're not that kind of guy. And that was the only way that I understood to handle, like, my questions about masculinity. And that was hard, and I was getting really depressed. And then my mom died, and I was in grief. And because I was in grief, you know, if you've ever been in grief, like, one feeling I had was anger, and I had a lot of other feelings. But anger was the only feeling that was, like, appropriate, it felt like, to express. And that was hard. So I was walking around angry. It's 2015, and I kept getting into these, like, street skirmishes, like street fights, basically. And they never came to blows. But this one summer, it was just, like, every month I was having these street fights. And then the last one really did come close to, like, an actual fight. And I know I was bringing to it a lot of frustration and just feeling like I couldn't, like, I had gone through all this and I couldn't be myself at the end of it, you know? But I also felt like the guy across from me, he kind of looked like newly divorced, you know what I mean? Like, he just looked like he was having a rough time. And we were having this, like, conflict that really, like, escalated and escalated. And in the end, like, so I sort of yelled at him and it got, like, weird and he walked away. But after that, I was like, I've got to start asking questions about how this is, like, what's going on and what's happening to me. So my first question was just, why do men fight? And I know you're not supposed to ask questions about masculinity. It's like Fight Club, you know, first rule of Fight Club. You don't never talk about Fight Club.
Wait, who told you that? No, seriously, like, speaking.
Every man I ever talked to, when I would say, why are we supposed to do this? Or what's up with this thing about being a man or whatever? And there was no answer. Like, there was no conversation ever in my life with any man that I tried to talk to about why men are the way they are.
Well, I guess
there was no depth of understanding.
I guess what I'm trying to get at, Thomas, is why you decided to pursue boxing as a lens for masculinity, as opposed to, you know, doing a Tough Mudder race or CrossFit or weightlifting or wrestling or any of the other kind of, you know, stereotypically manly man things. Why boxing?
Well, because my question was, why do men fight? And so boxing seemed like a place where men were fighting. So that seemed like an obvious place to start exploring that question. And so when I went into it, also relatedly, I was interested in, like, why men who have no reason to fight. So, like, men who are white collar boxers. And that's why I got interested in that particular vein of it. So I trained. And along the way, I wrote down or sort of condensed down every single question I had about being socialized male, because it was all coming up in the boxing ring. Then when I finished that, I went out and reported out all those questions, and that became my book. But the idea was, like, you know, here is this space that's homosocial, where there's a mix of classes, where there's a mix of races, where there's all kinds of different men, and we're all engaging with each other, and what comes up, you know, and what are the big questions that I had, you know, in this very kind of concentrated experiment that I was going through about what makes men men.
Were there any one or two big takeaways from your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of amazing takeaways. The biggest surprising one was that, you know, being in under what sociologists call the cover of violence, it totally changed my dynamic with the men around me. So in a way, it made me kind of sad. But in another way, I had so much more intimacy with these men because we were able to be really honest about, you know, our I mean, boxing is a sport about vulnerability, really. It's about, like, what is it that you, what's your weakness, and not about covering it up because you can't, because it's not a team sport. There's no real way to hide anything. So you have to be really in touch with, like, you know, your spiritual, physical, mental, emotional weaknesses and how that affects you in this sport. And then you have to sort of find a way to work with them. And everyone around you who's training with you can see all those things. So it was an incredibly intimate experience. That was really powerful. And learning how to have, you know, intimacy with other men in that way was really interesting. At the same time, like, a lot of the questions I had, you know, the biggest question I had that I got resolved actually had to do with testosterone as well. And that was, does testosterone make men aggressive? And I talked to Robert Sapolsky, the neurobiologist out of Stanford, and he told me that that's the biggest myth about testosterone. He said that testosterone doesn't make men aggressive. It makes men status seeking. And they've done economic games where the way that you win the game is by being cooperative. And so in those tests where that's the point of the game, the men with the highest testosterone levels win the games. But if they give men a placebo shot and they tell them it's testosterone in the same exact situation, men act like jerks in the games. So our ideas about what, you know, what men, what being a man means on, like, a biological level, the idea itself is so much more powerful than the actual reality. And that's, I think, really key to understanding masculinity.
Before I come back to Professor Jordan Young, Thomas, how do you feel about your use of testosterone, about your sense of masculinity? Do you feel good about it?
Well, those are two different questions. But I feel like my use of testosterone, I feel great about. I mean, I'm happy to be, you know, able to look the way I feel. So that feels really good. I mean, on a deeper level, it's always scary to be a pioneer. And I think that this moment for trans people is scary because we don't know what's going to happen to us, like, in the future. So I feel happy to be in my body. I feel lucky to be alive. And I also have no idea what all of this is going to, like, lead to down the road. And that's the risk that we're all taking. But how do I feel about my masculinity? I feel awesome about it because I learned to ask questions. I, like, learned to use my reporting skills and ask the tough questions and find the answers and to see the structural things that were holding up the worst parts of what I thought being a man meant, which we all have internalized. And I was able to expand what masculinity meant to include everything about me that came before, too. So I feel happy and like I have a more holistic sense of what being my gender really is.
Professor Karkazis, I wonder what your reaction is to Thomas's story. We've got a number of comments like the one that Dave sent. Dave emailed, testosterone is a hormone, masculinity is a state of mind. The two are not related. Professor Karkazis, what about Thomas's story?
I love Thomas's story. I love his book because part of what I think he's doing really is, whether we call it the man box or cultural norms or expected behaviors, for men is the idea of expanding that and expanding the lane that one has to be in to encompass a whole range of ways of being and still understand that as masculine. I was thinking as he was speaking, you couldn't see me because I was nodding my head, but I was really curious about how it related to this idea that Pharrell talked about recently in GQ, where he said, his view of masculinity is that which respects what isn't masculine. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really lovely way of talking about it. And yet masculinity is accorded a lot of respect. And
I'm not sure I quite understand the quote.
So I think if we could call Pharrell, that would probably be easiest, but there's only me. So what I understood him to be saying is whatever's in that man box at any particular cultural or historical moment, that we still value what's outside of it, mm-hmm. right? And so that even if you're living within that box, one of the problems around gender hierarchies and the way that things attached to masculinity can be elevated above things understood to be feminine is that certain behaviors get valued over others.
Hold that thought right there. We got to pause. I want to let you pick up in just 1 minute. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Thomas Page McBee, the author of Amateur, A Reckoning with Gender Identity and Masculinity, and professors Rebecca Jordan Young and Katrina Karkazis, the co-authors of Testosterone, An Unauthorized Biography. I'll get to some more of your comments in just a moment, but Professor Karkazis, let me let you quickly finish your thought.
Well, part of what I was thinking that I really love about what Thomas is saying is that he's raised in his comments a really fundamental question about what the relationship might be between biology and behavior. And in his writings, he gives this great example of how at a certain moment in meetings and conferences when he would speak up, all of a sudden he was respected in a way that he hadn't been prior. And some of that certainly, you know, can, well, how he describes it is it being tied to, in part, to having a lower voice, but also being a man in the way that he's accorded a certain authority. So testosterone didn't make him speak up more or barge into conversations or become a know-it-all or anything else, but it's in part how he was perceived. And so I think that combined questioning of what is actually testosterone affecting, and our book echoes his observation that there's actually a weak to non-existent link between testosterone and aggression, and yet that sedimented idea is widely accepted in society. And part of what Thomas, I think, is saying that's so powerful is it may not be how necessarily we're always acting, but in part how others perceive us, what they expect from us, and the kinds of ways that they treat us because there's a sense that we're men or that we have higher T or something like that.
Before we get to some comments, Professor Jordan Young, I should note that in the introduction to the book, you note that there are a number of aspects of our relationship with testosterone that you have chosen not to get into. You wanted to get into some of the more foundational questions. Among the things you chose not to get into are people who take testosterone, or maybe analogs of testosterone in the form of anabolic steroids, for athletic purposes. Why did you leave that out? That seems to be a big one.
Yeah, it is a big one. And, you know, there are lots of reasons why we did. But the main issue in leaving out any of the any extended look at a particular aspect of people taking testosterone and the whole exogenous thing is that people take testosterone as an aspirational act, that, you know, it's partly what you're getting is a particular molecule that you can almost guarantee at a certain level, if you're taking a whole lot more than your body is used to, your body is going to have some changes. And you can't always predict exactly what changes that's going to happen. But that does create this kind of looping process that Thomas described so beautifully in his book and that Katrina was talking about. And part of that, what we tried to do was figure out a way to get inside or underneath that, the sets of expectations that people have when they reach for testosterone aspirationally. So we kind of wanted to get to some of the more sort of fundamental ideas about what is it that we actually know and think that testosterone is already doing for us before we then get into that, the trickier territory about what happens when you take it. So, you know, Katrina and I have written and talked and worked a whole lot on some sports regulations that are about not allowing women with naturally high levels of testosterone to compete as women in elite sports. And people often would confuse the issue there with the question of doping. And
you're talking about people like Caster Semenya, who is the middle distance runner from South Africa. She got barred from competing because her testosterone levels are naturally higher.
Right, exactly.
But I'm talking about people who actually for instance, take anabolic steroids, which are analogs of testosterone. That would seem to be a really big piece of this culturally, especially because there are other documents, there are other efforts to understand why mostly men, but not exclusively, view testosterone the way they do. And as a culture that is very concerned about doping and performance-enhancing drugs and whether Barry Bonds belongs in the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame, that seems like a gigantic gap to leave out.
Well, you know, I would disagree. I don't think it's a gigantic gap to leave out because there are other people, you know, thinking and talking about sports. But I also just want to just quickly say that I think part of what Thomas described in terms of, you know, if somebody is taking their testosterone to a level that's way beyond what their body has already been used to, and they're doing every single kind of training and exercise and so on, is that going to give a person a boost? Yes, it doesn't actually affect every athlete in the same way. But there's a way in which it's, you know, we couldn't cover everything. That's a story that's kind of well known. But then the question is how to take apart this idea that that it's doing something that's singular. But I think Katrina has something that she'd like to – I'd like to hear.
Sure, and then we'll go to more audience comments. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think part of what we were thinking is if part of what we want to do here is look more closely at the link between testosterone and a particular set of behaviors, sort of the common sense ideas that everyone feels they know. Testosterone does this, it causes that, it makes this happen. What we didn't want to do was confound it with people who are taking it, where it gives them such high levels that it's adding something different than what you would typically find in the body. And so a lot of the studies we're looking at are, you know, studies that are looking at people's natural levels and trying to link them to particular behaviors. And those are the studies, not necessarily the exogenous ones, that are supporting a lot of the ideas about what people are doing. So, for example, aggression studies, risk-taking studies, those studies don't involve giving people testosterone. They very often involve looking at people's natural levels. And so that's a really clear way for us to say, without adding these very high doses that are changing the system in very complex and profound ways, is there actually a link before you even add it? And the answer is very often no, or it's weak.
Let me get to some more audience comments. Across the spectrum in terms of your views on and experiences with testosterone, Taco tweeted, testosterone therapy helped me feel calm and sleep. I was far from being irritable or angry. I was very calm, slept so well that I cried after my first night of sleep. Tom tweeted, thanks for these insights about testosterone. Let's hope one day we can eliminate labels or supposed tos and just be who we are outside of the boxes. Jeremy wrote on our Facebook page, great conversation. Correlation is not causation. Hormone uptake is unique in each human being. Hormone sensitivity is unique to the individual. How about we all have access to masculine and feminine dynamics and various ratios in given situations that can change over time and with experience? Thomas, I'd love to get your response to a message that one listener left through our app, 1A Vox Pop. Here is Rick from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Growing up, I didn't have the most positive masculine figures. So for me to realize that I was a transgender man was a lot for me to come to terms with. I started hormone replacement therapy about 2 years ago, and there have been a slew of physical and emotional changes that I've it's really opened my eyes to how men or people with higher levels of testosterone necessarily navigate emotions and how they respond to those. Before starting testosterone, I was somebody who, you know, would cry at least a few times a week in response to strong emotions. And now, instead, I sort of feel it build up bodily, and I get what I can only equate to feelings of anger instead. So that's been difficult for me to navigate in a healthy way.
Rick, thank you very, very much for sharing your story with us. Thomas, I guess in terms of how you and Rick navigated taking testosterone and what that would mean for your masculinity, I'm kind of curious, particularly in your case, as to why you went to a very hetero environment, why you went to straight men for answers, as opposed to gay men, because I think gay men have a very different view of testosterone and masculinity than straight men will.
It's interesting, Josh, that you think I only talked to straight men. I actually talked to plenty of men.
No. I'm not, that's your only did. But the story that I've heard so far about the boxing, that's what I'm referring to.
I got it. Well, first, let me respond to what Rick's saying, because I think that's very common amongst trans men initially. There's, you know, homeostasis is real, and a lot of things happen in your body the first few years that do change over time. And just if Rick's listening, like, I promise you're going to be able to cry again. It's a thing that many trans men report, and that does evolve. And also, I think, Rick, specifically, you should look and see, sort of check in with what's going on around you versus what you're experiencing by yourself or alone or with people you really trust, because there is definitely a heavy socialization element that is really hard to – that sort of feedback loop that we were describing earlier is so entrenched, it's hard to tell truly what's happening for you and what's happening to you. But in terms of, like, why did I go and look into boxing specifically, I wanted to talk to men who had really internalized – the narratives about masculinity in a deep way so that I could really expose to myself, you know, like, what is it that I've internalized, you know? And so I think that my interest in fighting and trying to look sort of at the, you know, the Jungian shadow of what masculinity is required me to go into, like, you know, literally the subterranean depths of where we were practicing that kind of masculinity. And actually, in doing so, it's not that I found in the end, you know, just a bunch of aggressive, roided out guys who wanted to beat the crap out of each other. It was, in fact, quite the opposite. I mean, I found expansions of masculinity within the most heteronormative, homosocial environment of masculinity. And that's part of why that was such an amazing revelation to me. And the other amazing revelation, because I know you asked me earlier, Joshua, was, you know, to what degree, how basically every expert I spoke to about masculinity cited boyhood and aspects of boyhood mm-hmm. as part of the construction of how we become the men we are, and the sort of the way we socialize boys from such young age. And there's a million studies of this, you know, in terms of, like, even something as small as, like, female infants are spoken more to than male infants by their mothers. And, you know, not to single out women, but I'm just saying every single piece of how we socialize boys turns boys into the men they are and creates those expectations of what being a man means. So, you know, I don't know. I think that there's, like, it's not that I went to straight men because I thought, or straight cis men, or mostly straight cis men, because I thought they were the, you know, the pinnacle of masculinity, but I did think that they'd internalized it on probably the deepest level, and that's why it was worth having conversations with them.
I know we're winding down. I want to get to some takeaways from everyone. I think it's interesting that the work that you've done has kind of blown up some of the preconceptions about testosterone and masculinity. I have to say that as a cisgender gay man, I am now, my head is spinning. I'm not sure exactly what to think.
Good.
And I mean, no, not good. Because I think it's good, but there are a lot of cis straight men in the audience who are like, well, thanks, Joshua. You've told us what's not real. What is real? For men who are in the middle of this debate about masculinity, you might have just made this harder without giving us something to rest on. So I want to hear from you. And I know that's not your intention, but I want to hear from you what you want to take away. Like, what do you now know more solidly? What do you know for sure? What are you more confident about, having blown up some of the misconceptions? Professor Karkazis, what do you want men to take away from this that you're more sure about as a result of digging into the data?
Well, I might veer a little bit from that in the sense that I think part of what Beck and I are doing in our book is actually recuperative for men, in the sense that we're trying to question a link between a singular molecule and whole ways of being. And the idea that we can take away is that there's a wide choice of ways of being within realms of socialization that aren't dependent on one's testosterone levels. And so certainly the idea that levels can get lower as men age, or that, you know, women might have low levels, that doesn't mean you're less of a man, less manly, less masculine, right? That's not sort of this natural process that happens. So I hope that our book actually helps in sort of a liberatory way around some of the pressure that's put on men around testosterone and behavior and shifting levels.
Professor Jordan Young, what about you?
Well, I hope that this loops in a couple of things that that we've been saying over the last 20 minutes. I was just thinking back to this whole looping effect idea. One of the things that I've come away with is recognizing that some of the questions that people have can't be answered by the kinds of studies that we would like to do because of the wide array of effects that testosterone has. You can't do placebo-controlled studies at very, very high levels because you're going to change bodies and then you suddenly invoke all those social processes that Thomas and Katrina and I have been talking about. But I guess the message to if there are men that are feeling, you know, frustrated with this and what's coming out, I guess my bottom line would be, first of all, none of us are stuck with some Paleolithic version of what human nature is or what male nature is, and that we happen to be in a moment right now of a lot of insecurity and social change and, masculinity. I think, you know, there's a particular kind of, advertising that's being done right now to men to play on every single insecurity and feeling of being overwhelmed and exhausted and not up to the task of what men are supposed to be doing.
Right.
And, you know, selling testosterone, taking testosterone, isn't actually going to answer any of that. And mm-hmm. I think men need to recognize that that's very manipulative.
Rebecca Jordan-Young and Katrina Karkazis, the co-authors of Testosterone, an Unauthorized Biography. Professors, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Thomas Page McBee, his book is called Amateur, A Reckoning with Gender, Identity, and Masculinity. Thomas, thank you.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink. You can learn about our team at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.